from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America's finances are deep in the red and going much deeper. With every day of war and reconstruction, federal coffers take a hit. But the table was set for exploding deficits well before the war, the result of a stalled economy and huge tax cuts. Tonight, On Point, the cost of war, the deficit, and who will pay and how, chances are, says our guest, you're it. We begin with the latest developments in Iraq, which today produced wild images and reports of widespread looting and chaos in Baghdad and other cities. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said this afternoon, one can understand the pent-up feelings that may result from decades of repression. But the defense secretary said reports of anarchy were exaggerated and chalked the impression up to the endless replaying of a relatively few scenes of disorder. Charles Heyman is editor of Jane's World Armies. I asked him for his assessment of what's happening in Iraq.
I don't think it's the same loop being shown over and over again on TV. I spoke to someone this afternoon on a sat phone. I've been speaking to him all the way through the campaign. He's now in Baghdad. Now, he says the situation there, as far as he can see, is grave. He's been around the world a lot. He's an old soldier, and he's seen a lot of crises in the past. He says that the most immediate worry is that there will be factional fighting between Sunnis and Shias. But there is serious anarchy and looting, and people are very, very worried about the next few days. The people that really suffer, of course, in circumstances like this are the ordinary citizens, who the law-abiding citizens, who really are at great risk from the mobs and from the armed men. And there are lots of armed gangs apparently wandering around Baghdad. And there's very little that the coalition forces can do to stop them at the moment, because the coalition forces are still involved in fighting battles in various areas of Baghdad. And of course, they're just not configured for this. I mean, you can't impose order on the streets using tanks and armored vehicles. You really do need large numbers of lightly armed, light infantry type soldiers and paramilitaries such as military police. So something has got to happen in the next 48 hours. But right at this moment, it is probably beyond the capabilities of the coalition troops to impose order.
And Charles Heyman, what's your interpretation then of the significance of what we're seeing for the future in terms of the size and long-term commitment, or at least medium-term commitment, of foreign troops to Iraq?
Well, there is almost certainly going to have to be commitment of a very large force to Iraq for probably the foreseeable future. And that force is, first of all, going to have to back up and support any new regime in Iraq. And it's going to have to impose law and order until some sort of viable force can be organized that can do it for the new Iraqi government. And it is very, very important that we act quickly to restore law and order and impose the coalition's authority on the country, not only in Baghdad and Basra, but in all the other towns. And we've had a really good look at the map over the last couple of days. There's at least 30 towns, we reckon, of reasonable size that are going to need some sizable contingents of troops. And it's really important this happens if we are to win the peace. I mean, after all this sacrifice and all this effort, it would be a tragedy if we don't get our act together properly to win a lasting peace in Iraq.
Baghdad, Kirkuk, and Mosul all fallen in the space of this week. Surprising? What's happened to the Iraqi military?
That's the $64,000 question. The answer almost certainly is that dictatorships never inspire the loyalty that normal countries with a joined-up government, where at least everybody feels part of the nation, they don't inspire that sort of loyalty. The people right down at the bottom end know what the situation is, and they're not going to sell their lives for the Ba'ath Party and 100 major functionaries and Saddam Hussein. One of the telltale signs of a country that's about to go is when 99% of the population vote for the president, as they did for Saddam Hussein before Christmas. Whenever you get that sort of vote in favor of someone, it means that the people have been trucked out and they've voted through fear.
The one remaining spot on the map, Tikrit, Saddam Hussein's hometown, and we hear stories of Iraqi military leaving even there. Is there a tough fight ahead? Is it going to be another melting away before U.S. troops?
Yeah, my own feeling here is that there's not going to be much fighting at Tikrit. Certainly not the sort of fighting that we've seen so far. No joined-up conventional military operations. By the time the coalition get to Tikrit, anyone with any common sense inside either the Iraqi army or the Republican Guard will be heading for home. And the Ba'ath Party in Tikrit will probably be fleeing themselves to try and save themselves. So I don't think we're going to see much more in the way of conventional military operations. But there could be an ongoing low-level guerrilla campaign going on for some time. And it's too early to get pessimistic about that. We really do have to see how things pan out over the next few weeks.
But it sounds as though you're saying, Charles Heyman, that at the grand scale, this war's over.
I do think at the grand scale, the war is over. Ongoing guerrilla, low-intensity, guerrilla-type operations, highly possible that there are quite a number of jihadis coming in from elsewhere in the Middle East to have a go at coalition forces. But I think certainly at the grand scale, the war appears to be over. And, you know, you have to say at the end of the day, coalition forces have done a great job, but the Iraqi military has been surprisingly incompetent. They didn't blow up a single bridge, and they could have at least delayed the coalition forces by doing that. They had ample opportunity and dozens of bridges, and they never managed to get it together. One of the conclusions you can draw from this campaign is certainly that the Russian-Soviet doctrine, style of war, equipment, tactics, are now totally discredited. If you use this system, which has probably been stationary, basically, since the 1950s, early 1960s. It hasn't evolved. If you use this system, you're doomed. The NATO system has been constantly evolving, constantly being refined, constantly practiced. And I think this is a demonstration, by and large, of the NATO-type U.S. style of warfare over this Soviet military doctrine.
Charles Heyman, a remarkable 3 weeks. Thank you for joining us at what looks like, as you say, the end of the grand scale of the war. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Charles Heyman is a retired major in the British Army and editor of Jane's World Armies. He spoke with us earlier from Shrewsbury, England. Just 3 years after the federal budget deficit was riding a big surplus, the deficit in Washington has exploded to more than $300 billion, and that was before the war in Iraq. Factor in war costs, and America's deficit could balloon to $400 billion. That's just this year. President Bush's controversial tax cuts and proposals for more are leading America deeper into the red and threaten to do so, says our guest tonight, for years to come. The bill for all this red ink, he says, is likely to land on you and land hard. Healthcare, education, private investment, interest rates, and much more will be hit. Republican critics say these critics just don't get it. This critic says the Bush White House is in the thrall of a disastrous dream. Tonight we're talking about the cost of war, the deficit, and who will pay. Where will the bill fall for the war in Iraq? Will President Bush's tax plan and global big stick pull America out of the sea of red or deeper into it? Is America's future being downsized by deficits or saved by them? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Jeff Madrick, contributing economic columnist for the New York Times. His article, The Iraqi Time Bomb, about the cost of war and the burgeoning deficit, appeared in the most recent New York Times magazine. Good evening and welcome, Jeff Madrick.
Hello there.
Thanks for being with us. Jeff Madrick, you describe the nation forging along through war, and meanwhile, in the background, this enormous ocean of red ink waiting to swallow everything up. How big, how bad, and are you sure? The Bush administration is telling us it doesn't matter. It's the right thing to do right now.
Right. Well, I think, as I wrote in the piece, fantasy has migrated from Wall Street to Washington. And I am not a deficit hawk, I hasten to add. I don't worry about deficits as much as a lot of economists. I don't always think they crowd out private investment and so forth.
So why sure that this time it's bad?
Because events have turned so sharply, and these tax cuts are so irresponsible. In light of that, the economy has weakened significantly. Some of it was unexpected, but not to this extent. The fiscal health of the economy was exaggerated in the the federal government was exaggerated in the late 1990s because of capital gains taxes, swelling coffers. That's disappeared. And then add to that these tax cuts, which will take $1.5 or $2 trillion out of the tax revenues for the next couple of years. And you've got a serious situation of high deficits. The real problem is while we could use deficits, well-structured deficits right now to ameliorate this stagnating, slow and probably recessionary economy.
And they're a very traditional mechanism for restarting.
Say it again?
They're a very traditional mechanism for pulling economies out of the doldrums.
Right. If you structure the spending or the tax cuts correctly, this presidency has done almost the opposite of what we need. Big tax cuts down the road to people who will save it, not spend it, rather than spending now, tax cuts now to get us out of this slump, and then have those tax cuts disappear or at least decline in future years when we're growing again at full capacity.
So, Jeff Mendrick, walk us through this. How big are the deficits that you and others foresee? How long do they go on? And with what consequences? Who pays?
Well, when the Bush administration took office, they and the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, the bipartisan arm of Congress, are forecasting surpluses that would accumulate to $5.6 trillion over 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Within 2 years, that has reversed, and now it will be a deficit that accumulates to nearly $2 trillion over 10 years. If some of that deficit were occurring, much of that deficit were occurring right now, mm-hmm. and structured in a good way, we might be able to pop out of this recession quickly.
But it's backloaded.
Those tax cuts get bigger and bigger down the road.
And what does that matter?
Because we keep having deficits even when we're running at full capacity. An economy that's running deficits, even when it's growing as rapidly as it probably can grow.
You're saying down the road, when it comes back, and even if it gets all the way revved up, still won't put us back in the black.
It won't put us back in the black, and that does, and I do not say this very often, that does begin to crowd out private investment, make it difficult to keep productivity growing at its potential rate. It will slow growth. It will slow the growth rate of incomes over time.
And the social impact, the economic social impact?
Here's what I think the real message is. The real message is the Bush administration probably knows that we're not going to accept all that. Now that's let me make this clear, okay?
Mm-hmm,
that's
mm-hmm.
probably the optimistic case.
The $2 billion deficit going right on out?
The trillion deficit is probably the optimistic case. The realistic case is probably closer to $4 trillion because a lot of spending is left out of that deficit. And also it really doesn't take into account, in my view, probably some of the slow growth that will be a consequence of crowding out, although the CBO would argue probably that it does. But in any case, that's kind of the optimistic case, so let's keep that in mind. So we get down the road and we grow more slowly. It hurts incomes more. It hurts incomes for all of us. And then what happens 10 years from now? We start facing the baby boomer bulge in retirement, which means Social Security liabilities and Medicare liabilities start their inexorable climb over the next 20 years.
At almost the same time when this deficit is ballooning to this enormous size, as you foresee.
When the deficit is accumulating to an enormous
mm-hmm,
size.
Mm-hmm.
We're still running deficits and we hit this problem. So what you've got to hypothesize is kind of growth. To make this sound right, to make this come together, you've got to hypothesize a kind of growth miracle.
We're going to come back and look at that growth miracle, Jeff Mendrick, but I want to ask you first, you call this the Iraqi time bomb. How much of this are you laying on the war, or is it simply the war plus the lack of debate about the future, at least as you paint it?
Yeah, it's not only the war, but we haven't even included the war in this $2 trillion calculation, and even the $4 trillion calculation by a couple of economists at Goldman Sachs has a very modest cost for war and peace, and as your earlier interview suggested, we may indeed need to keep lots of troops there to maintain the peace in Iraq, which is not calculated yet. So we're, in addition to which, as you well know, we have a different foreign policy attitude, quite an adventurous one that's likely to be quite costly.
We do. We'll come back and talk about that, Jeff Madrick. Yeah. Please stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking about the price of war and looming deficits, how big they'll be, and who will pay. Where is the bill for the war in Iraq going to land? And what about those deficits? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From Boston University, this is WBUR.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the price of war and looming deficits, how big they'll be and who will pay. Some critics are saying they're way, way too big, and even a return to economic growth will not pull the U.S. out of these deficits. Republicans around the Bush White House say, you just don't get it. There's something new happening here, something different. The president's got a big vision, and it's going to work. What do you think? Do you believe the Bush economic formula will pull growth out of a sea of red? Or is America's future being downsized by deficits and war bills? Does the Bush administration care if social spending is decimated? Or is that the whole point? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I've been talking with Jeff Madrick, with a contributing economic columnist for the New York Times, editor of Challenge magazine, and author of Why Economies Grow. Jeff Madrick, I wish you'd focus in for just a second on your sense of what the consequences of this great arc of deficit will be. How will it hit American individuals, American families, American institutions?
Well, we're going to grow more slowly. Number one, we are going to grow more slowly than we can grow, which means slower income growth for lots of people, falling incomes for a lot of people, I think, over time. Number two, it will keep us from making the investments we need to ensure that both productivity are growing. And I think some of the investments the government has to make in education, transportation, infrastructure, research and development, maybe quality daycare, early education for children, some of the policies we know work, they will not have the revenues to make those kinds of important public investments, which have been neglected, in truth, in many cases for 20 years.
And what about baseline programs, Social Security, Medicaid,
right.
Veterans benefits? You're describing cuts or at least something like cuts in all of those.
Yeah, and then ultimately, not only may we not make the investments we need, we may begin to start cutting cherished social programs. The House has passed a budget resolution that tries to balance this budget. The Bush people are saying we're not going to really try to balance this budget. In fact, we're not even going to do the traditional 10-year forecast. We're just going to do a 5-year forecast because we don't know what's going to happen in the second 5 years. So they are telling us. Would that we could all think of our lives that way. But the House cannot do that. So they came up with a budget resolution that required them to balance the budget based on these CBO forecasts. And it called for severe cuts in veterans benefits, school lunches, loans for college, Medicaid.
In other words, their projections kind of bake into the cake these cuts. Jeff Madrick, you know, not long ago we had a kind of a clash of Nobel titans on this hour. Mm-hmm. Paul Samuelson was with us, Milton Friedman, and of course they came down on very different sides of this. Paul Samuelson argued it a lot like you are, but Milton Friedman said, wait a minute, government spending has never been efficient. It never will be. If it's squeezed out, that's all for the good.
Yeah, well, he's wrong. Government has been integral to economic growth since the beginning of this republic. Government built the Erie Canal. Was that inefficient? Was that unimportant to economic growth?
Mm.
Government built the primary schools that were the envy of the world by the 1830s and 1840s. Government subsidized the building of railroads. They subsidized agricultural technology in the 1800s. They ensured competition when elite corporations and individuals tried to stifle competition.
So you're attributing to the government all this infrastructure of economic success. You know Bush Republicans are looking at it differently. Jeff Madrick, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Washington, Kevin Hassett, resident scholar and director of economic policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Good evening and welcome, Kevin Hassett.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Kevin Hassett, you hear and know the critique that Jeff Madrick and any number of others are making at this point. You've written recently about what you call the Deficit Club, and you don't mean an organization, but rather a cudgel. You say Republicans picked it up in the 90s, Democrats are picking it up for purely political reasons. But Jeff Madrick lays out a case that when you read it, it makes the hair stand up on the back of one's neck a bit, doesn't it? Is this really all just scare talk?
Well, you know, Jeff always makes good cases, and it's always worthwhile thinking about what he's got to say. You know, I think that the problem for me in this debate is that if you go back and look at the zillion papers, and Jeff knows about this, that have tried to find effects of deficits on things, they've generally been unable to. And we could even, you know, just to put it in perspective, think about the most recent experience. If I had to ask you, Tom, to pick, say, the best 5 years that we've had in the last 20, you might pick, say, 96 to 2000 or right, somewhere in there.
They sure felt good at the time.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, guess what? You know, in 1992, the deficit situation was about twice as bad relative to GDP as it is now. And going up into that glory time, we had deficits that were much bigger than what we're talking about now.
But the baby boom is something new, isn't it? With that hurtling toward the kind of numbers that Jeff Madrick is laying out, isn't it sounds like a recipe for some kind of bad crunch. Don't you think so?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely true that if you look at the long-run balance of the Social Security system and Medicare, that it's just wildly out of balance. But the reason that it's out of balance is that the benefits are very, very generous and very costly, so that the proportion of government spending to GDP, now that's, say around 20% of GDP,
yeah,
climbs over 75 years to be in almost half of GDP.
Wait, so here's the rub. So this what you seem to be saying, Kevin, has it seems to bear out Jeff Madrick's suspicion and more that the real agenda here is to cut back on benefits. Is that what I'm hearing? I mean, that's where we'll end up,
know,
and it's
I'm
fine by you because they're too generous to begin with.
What I'm saying is that if we want to, so there is this long run deficit problem coming for sure. And then, you know, we've got this thing that we've got to face that everyone's ducking the question, you know, are we going to raise taxes to be in, you know, 45-50% of GDP, or are we going to cut benefits? And that's not the debate that we're having. And so it tends to be kind of unsatisfying to talk around the points, you know. But looking at the Bush budget, you know, if I were a deficit hawk, the thing that I would be furious about, which you never hear opponents mention, is the Medicare spending. Because Medicare is sort of already the biggest problem probably in the long run, or at least, you know, just about as big as Social Security. And we've got this big expansion of benefits in the Bush budget of $400 billion over the next 10 years, which is bigger than the dividend tax cut, which is the thing that people cite when you know, talking about deficits. And in the piece I wrote, I just said, geez, you know, it's kind of interesting to go back and look and see that in the contract with America that Newt Gingrich drew up, that the big item in the contract was that they wanted a balanced budget because they wanted to end the terrible age of deficit.
Yeah, I just want to be sure I understand one thing that Kevin Hassett here then. You seem to be saying that, indeed, America cannot afford the life it's been living, that it must get used to the idea of smaller government benefits for everybody, seniors included.
Or it needs to raise taxes a whole lot. And that's a perspective on the long-run problem. Jeff also made a lot of short-run points. We could get to those in a minute.
Well, let me turn to Jeff Madrick for a moment. Jeff, is this the what you call the more radical agenda of the Bush administration being articulated by Kevin Hassett here, that, yes, we're going to cut all this social spending, and that's just the way it's got to be?
Well, Kevin has the great quality of honesty, but I think, yes, that's exactly my fear. That $400 billion Medicare proposal is for drug benefits for the elderly because drug prices are soaring.
But if you're
exactly
upset about
I mean.
Deficits, it should upset you. That's on. So you can't say these terrible things are going to happen because of deficits, because the deficits have come from tax cuts, but they won't happen from Medicare.
Surely you can. If you want to keep a decent social net, if you want to have humane policies, then you can't have the tax cuts. The deficits come because I assume, at least I hope, that we're going to want
some of these policies.
But Jeff Medrick,
I think they're necessary not only for a humane society and a politically stable society, and indeed an optimistic society.
Depends on those. Jeff Medrick, let me put the question to you this way, though. Kevin Hassett is saying, we just can't afford this stuff. Are you saying we can afford it, but the Bush administration ideologically prefers not to have the state involved in people's lives, even in what have traditionally been considered kind of humane, necessary humane interventions?
Nothing could be simpler. If we did not give tax cuts that largely go to the rich, we could afford many of these things. This is not a matter. You can't turn this around and say this is a matter of social spending being too high. This is a matter of quite, I think it's fair to say, even radical tax cut proposals that will undermine our ability to pay for social programs that many people want, that many intelligent, wise, and compassionate people believe are necessary.
Why would anyone want to do that? Why do you imagine, Jeff Medrick, anybody would want to do that if these are as integral to the country's economic success as you suggest?
I think, Pete, I think this is a strong matter of ideology. I think there are people who dislike government spending, no matter what it is, who believe it somehow impedes economic growth, but that is very hard to prove with the economic evidence. And number three, in crasser political terms, if you deprive the Democrats of social programs for the constituencies, you make it, I think, in the Republican mind, you make it harder for them to win elections and you hold office.
So you appeal to the wealthy and make everybody else dependent on them, I guess. Jeff Medrick.
I don't think anything is more clear. And I think Kevin probably agrees with this.
Kevin Hassett?
Well, you know, I don't know. There's a lot that Jeff said that I don't agree with, that's for sure.
Put your fork in wherever you like.
I think that as we move towards these problems, then they're going to be a lot easier to deal with if we're a big, healthy, wealthy economy. And I think that moving towards that state, we need to think, you know, what parts of our tax system are broke. You know, I wish that the dividend tax thing, which I think is really good tax policy, and it's, you know, something that's been adopted by, you know, most of Europe, and, you know, we've got the highest dividend taxes on earth, and it's good policy. I just wish the debate was, well, okay, if the deficit guys are really worried about it, then why don't we, you know, raise something else? Because I in an instant would trade a percentage point of the top marginal income tax rate for the dividend tax thing. But
well, I wouldn't. Not only would I not disagree with that, I have written that. But that's not what the Bush administration is doing.
No, but I think that's not what the Democrats are doing either, Jeff. If the Democrats came to bat with that, you know, maybe that's the kind of debate we'd be having. Instead, it's just all about
stronger politics. I don't think the Democrats think there's a prayer in the world that they could get a Republican Congress to raise the marginal rate on wealthy people these days.
And I've got to imagine that that's a pretty good assessment on their part. Jeff Medrick, Kevin Hassett, stand by. A lot of people want to join us. I want to invite them in. Pete's calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, Pete. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
My comment more comes from just a discussion on, it might not be in such economic, don't look at every economic term out there that the Bush administration is trying to come across, is that what's happening is you wonder what has happened in the 90s through a Democratic presidency. Whether that was a Republican presidency or not, it really wouldn't matter, but people just are so used to getting everything they want. And what we have in Massachusetts seems to be the problem, whether you're familiar with this side or not. But everyone's complaining about a budget deficit, but they keep forgetting that the budget deficit is only a deficit and spending needs to be cut because the agencies are asking for more money all the time.
Well, there's a lot more Americans in the baby boom generation who are piling into those brackets all the time, Pete. But let me get some response to this in just a moment. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I made a pledge to NPR because I have a personal connection over to the war. My boyfriend's over on the front lines with the Marines. And I found that the actual news coverage coming across the television has not been as objective as what I'm finding on NPR. So I think it brings home the idea that we really are at war and that this is not something that's a reality show on television. And that's basically why I decided it was time. you guys had put off your spring fundraiser because the war had started. You guys had postponed it a few weeks. And I heard that, and I said, you know, it's time for me to actually pledge. Because first, I thought that was a very admirable thing to do because the country was at war. And second, that you felt that the war outweighed the actual financial push, which I'm not sure if a lot of news stations have done the same things. And I could only imagine how tough it is for you guys if you're getting money just from the listeners. I'm Rebecca Love, and I'm from Brookline.
Thanks, Rebecca. That's great. Fantastic to hear from you. We're so glad that WBUR can be a companion for you and keep you informed on what's happening over in Iraq. And we sure appreciate the contribution that you've made to continue this kind of coverage.
The reason we can be your companion is through listener support. Other listeners who've made contributions, well, we're asking for your help now to make yours at 1-800-909-9287 or online at wbur.org.
And as Rebecca said, that she tunes to us because we're objective and we bring you unbiased coverage of the war in Iraq and all the stories that we cover. And that's one of the many reasons why it's important to keep this kind of objective reporting coming with your support.
1-800-909-9287. That's the phone number to call to join Rebecca and all of the other listeners who've picked up the phone and made a contribution for programs, the programs that you enjoy from WBUR On Point and all of the others that you listen to on a daily basis.
We're in hour one of On Point where they're examining the financial costs of the current war in Iraq. Another look at a major news story, another delving in to related relevant issues that are on your mind at this time. And it's the kind of quality news that you help pay for when you call 1-800-909-9287. So take a moment now, be as generous as you can, put it on a credit card, because then we can put the money to work right away. If you're online, you can go to wbur.org.
What's great about On Point is that you get to add your voice to the conversation. You can pick up the phone and call Tom Ashbrook and his guests and ask them directly how you think the deficit will be affected by the war in Iraq. That's what the topic of conversation is tonight. Tom has excellent guests lined up as usual, and he also turns to you, the listener, to give your point of view.
If you make sure that you're able to listen to On Point, if you go out of your way to tune in WBUR at 7 o'clock to hear what Tom Ashbrook and his guests and other listeners like you are saying, then it's important for you to support the program right now. 1-800-909-9287. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Corey McPherson Nash, a design firm developing branding, print, and interactive communication solutions. Thoughtful design embedded in creative strategy. CMN Design. And the Ewing Marion Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, encouraging entrepreneurship across America, emkf.org. Wellington Management Company, providing investment advice to clients worldwide.
We'll be going back to Tom and On Point in just a few moments. Why not put this time to good use, helping to pay for the program that's important to you, like On Point, by calling 1-800-909-9287 and making a generous contribution, or online at wbur.org.
On Point tops off an incredible day of news and information programming, starting in the morning with Morning Edition, followed by the BBC international news that we rely on and we're bringing you more of as the war in Iraq continues. And then you've got The Connection, where you can also add your voice to the conversation here and now for the latest updates in the middle of the day. And the programming goes on and continues even at an hour like this, where you might be winding down your day, but it's a fresh new program. On Point is live, and you can pick up the phone and join the conversation.
WBUR supporters also include Nortec, creating building products to help improve the comfort and security of homes and workplaces around the world, and Essex Partners, providing career advice, consulting services, and new opportunities to senior executives in transition in Boston and on the web at essexpartners.com. And Brigham's Ice Cream, introducing the new Brigham's Ice Cream Bar, made with their own vanilla ice cream and covered in milk chocolate or dark chocolate, now available in local supermarkets.
Our costs are very real. This type of news programming is extremely expensive. We're spending $8.5 million to bring you the news.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the price of war and looming deficits, how big they'll be, and who will pay. You can join the conversation. Is the fog of war obscuring the real debate on the fundamentals of the American future? What will be the legacy of the Bush deficit, tax cuts, and war? Growth and health, or shrunken horizons? Is this the road to the kinder, gentler nation, or something tougher and meaner? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight, Edward McKelvey, senior economist at Goldman Sachs, Jeff Madrick, contributing economic columnist for the New York Times, and Kevin Hassett, resident scholar and director of economic policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute. And right now, Charles calling from Pullman, Washington State. Good evening, Charles. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I guess what my common question is, the simplistic argument that the Republicans use to argue in favor of these tax cuts, the simplistic argument is that they stimulate the economy and actually generate more tax revenue than is lost by the tax cut, which I think is, you know, silly in a sense, because with that argument, you would tax $0 and you would make the most revenue that could possibly be made. In other words, if you keep moving toward tax cuts, it would finally end up at zero, and according to their projections, they'd end up with a maximum amount.
Well, at zero, that would be tough, but something asymptotically approaching zero, maybe.
Yeah, and so my concern is this, is that I'm worried that what's going to happen is that they're going to continue to cut taxes, and the uncertainty in the economy and people's concerns and worries about the economy are going to make it such that these tax cuts aren't going to stimulate the economy. The economy is going to stay in its doldrums just based on the emotions of the population. And
we're not going to kick it back into gear with everything that suggests. Charles, thanks for your observation and your call. Edward McKelvey, what's your view sitting at Goldman Sachs?
Sounds like it comes in my bailiwick. I think you get some stimulus, but I guess I would agree with the general thrust of the question that these are not highly stimulative tax proposals. We figure maybe they help GDP by 0.5% or something, which isn't a lot. I mean, on a given year. I'm sure Kevin will argue that on a long-term basis, the dividend tax proposal will do more than that, but I don't think so.
Let me put it to you another way then, and this gets a little bit outside of economics, but do you think, Edward McKelvey, look from your perch at Goldman Sachs, that the Bush administration has been straightforward, has been honest about what's up with these tax cuts? Here, our caller in Washington State is saying he sees these as having been offered up to promise stimulus. He doesn't buy it, but that's how he sees the packaging.
Yeah, I think not entirely. I guess my answer would be not entirely. I mean, they had originally shied away from using words like stimulus and presenting it in those terms. But the fact of the matter is they are talking about how the economy is not doing well enough, mm-hmm. and here's a tax package that's going to help it do better. So the natural presumption is that that's what part of the motivation of doing the taxes. I think the dividend tax cuts also being proposed for tax reform reasons. But if I could sort of suggest, a litmus test question on whether you ought to do the tax, the dividend tax cut for tax reform reasons, ask this question: if you want to reform taxes and pay for that tax cut, as many people would argue you should do, how about a trade? We'll give you the dividend tax cut if you take away the mortgage interest deduction, which is also a distortion in the tax code.
Everybody's howling already.
How many people are going to vote for that?
Well, I can think of a few who won't.
Yes, and a few who won't get elected if it happens. I mean,
but we take your point. You're saying balance out this picture.
Sleight of hand here.
Kevin Hassett?
Yes, Tom, I think it's interesting to put that number, which I think is a little modest, the 0.5%, into perspective. You know, the annual revenue cost of the dividend tax cut is around $30 billion a year. And the 0.5% of GDP effects that we just got out of Goldman Sachs is about $50 billion a year. And that's not $50 billion in revenue, it's $50 billion in the pockets of Americans.
So
if we just let Americans keep $30 billion of their money, then GDP goes up.
If you gentlemen will forgive me, we can get so deep in those numbers that we won't come out again. But Kevin Hassett, I want to ask you this. I heard you say earlier that even with the growth that this should produce, we're still going to have to turn to major cuts, as I understood you, in social spending that Americans have become accustomed to.
Oh, but yeah, or another way to put it is, unless you want to more or less double taxes, then yeah, you're going to have to cut welfare benefits, Medicare benefits, and Social Security benefits going forward.
But Jeff Madrick, do you agree, or is this coming back to an ideological position that some people want to cut these?
Yeah, I maybe I could weigh in on this. I would like to go back to that question. A doubling tax. I'm not quite sure which taxes Kevin means.
Well, I took the trustees' report long run forecast of how much we're spending on all these things, and took it relative to GDP, and it's up well above 40%.
Boil it down fast, guys, because you're losing me.
Twice as much tax revenue as we've got coming in now we need in 70 years if we don't change Social Security and Medicare.
As a proportion of GDP?
That's right.
I'm not sure. The numbers, that just doesn't ring true to me. The numbers, and I think the numbers Ed used for Social Security and Medicare are something like 12% of GDP in the mid-2030s. But let me return to the point that the man from Washington State made. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very good point. I don't think Americans are confident in this administration. This administration comes and keeps telling them tax cuts are great. They kept promising a good economy. Then they, out of the clear blue sky, they come up with a dividend tax exclusion. People are not foolish. They know an awful lot of that is going to wealthy people. They know there are sort of concocted arguments that somehow this is going to help us more than tax cuts to them, the workers, but in truth it won't. What we really needed was a solid, straightforward, near-term stimulus for an economy that's in trouble right now, and that stimulus more or less goes away down the line.
Jeff Madrick, we've only got a minute left. Are we headed on this path to a different America, an America we would not recognize today?
Well, I think we've been headed on that path for quite some time, and I think the ultimate strategy is to deprive the American nation of tax revenue so it has to cut social spending.
And what does that leave us with? What kind of – Kevin Hassett, how do you picture that future?
Oh, you know, I think the future is a good one. One of the things we have to remember is one of the reasons why these programs are spinning out of control is that as we get wealthier and wealthier, we're paying ourselves better and better benefits.
So you're saying we'll all pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps and be better off for it?
I think that's right. I mean, if you look at our economic performance relative to that of France, you know, I wouldn't trade our economy for that of France. But in France, we've got a lot of the social protections that Jeff
has. Oh, that is such nonsense, Kevin. Come on.
You would trade for France?
I think there's a very strong argument that a middle-income person in France, and I know this will sound sacrilegious to you, because of those benefits, lives better than a middle-income person in America.
And for tonight, we're going to have to leave it right there, Jeff Madrick. We've got it. Jeff Madrick, I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight. We're out of time, but it's been great having you. Jeff Madrick is contributing economic columnist for the New York Times and author of Why Economies Grow. And Edward McKelvey, senior economist at Goldman Sachs, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
And Kevin Hassett, resident scholar and director of economic policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute, thank you very much for being with us. Kevin Hassett joined us from Washington. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Just click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is Jim Infantino from Brighton, Massachusetts. I pledged back in January, I think it was, and I pledged sort of a regular amount, what I can afford sort of every month. And this is the first fundraiser that I've gotten to listen to, having done that. What I've just noticed is that I'm listening without remorse. I'm listening without any hints of guilt, and listening to the fundraiser is suddenly an enjoyable thing as opposed to all these years before when I would kind of listen and feel like I really should do something and not doing it. So I guess I wanted to kind of advise people who are on the fence to say, you know, you should really go ahead because it feels so much better to be on this other side of that.
Jim is feeling better now because he made a contribution to the news. I wonder how many other people out there sitting there sitting there thinking, I used to be Jim, I am Jim,
or how many
I still
are still
am.
Sitting right. on the fence wondering, should they not?
Right.
Well, you know, we've actually got a lot of listeners who feel pretty good because we've gotten that $500,000 goal down to about 273, but we want to get it down to about 270 before we go back to the news at 8 o'clock. So if you haven't made that contribution in a while, now's a great time to do it because you know how much news we've been giving you of late, how important it's been, and that costs a lot of money, and we need your help to do it. So 1-800-909-9287 is the number to call to help out.
And, in fact, a lot of people have joined Jim tonight and over over the last few days in making a contribution for these programs on WBUR, programs such as On Point. There's so many others, though. There's a lot of really good shows on WBUR with some very talented and dedicated individuals working to bring you these programs every day. It's producers, it's writers, and many people that you don't necessarily hear their names or hear them on the air.
Behind the scenes, what goes on here, I think, would surprise many people because it comes off sounding smooth radio. That's what we want to give to our listeners, and that's why you tune to us. But behind all of that is Gina says there are producers and editors and writers and, technical support people who keep it all coming to you. And all of that costs money.
And that's where we need your help, because it's listener contributions that pay half those costs. The single largest source of income here is from listener support. So take a moment now before we go back to the news, the latest news from National Public Radio, and then hour two of On Point, and make a contribution as generous as you can, because remember, you're helping to pay for the news that's important to you. 1-800-909-9287 or online at WBUR.org.
And I have to say, too, that I'm so glad that many of the listeners have chosen to share the reasons that they listen to WBUR with us. Because it's really interesting to hear the remarks and to hear why people tune to WBUR, why they rely upon it. And they all have, some of them have the same reasons, but there's a lot of different reasons why people listen to WBUR.
It's interesting. You know, we're on one side of the radio and the listeners are on the other, and sometimes we don't always get to get feedback as direct as what we've just heard from that listener saying that he feels guilt-free now that he's helped pay for the news, and that makes him feel good, and maybe it'll make you feel good if you pick up the phone.
Well, it'll certainly help pay for the news, that's for sure. 1-800-909-9287 or online at WBUR.org. Do it now, because we'll be going back to the news in just a few short minutes. 1-800-909-9287 or WBUR.org.
I feel I don't give very much to your radio station, and I felt that you must indeed be putting yourself out 3 or 4 or 5 times the ordinary for your station. I mean, you're reaching the front lines and you're reaching all over the world for this. And I felt you're making a big effort, so I thought I could make a big effort.
And we appreciate that effort. Thank you very much for the contribution. And you're right. There are reporters that have been sent to Iraq, and they're on the ground there and doing the reports, all of these reports that we've been hearing about the war in Iraq, northern Iraq, reports from there that we've been hearing, Baghdad, and reporters at the Pentagon, too, bringing us the latest information from what officials are saying about the war. And this is what your contributions pay for.
We're about to hear another report from the front line in Iraq coming up in the first hour, in the second hour of On Point. It's going to start with a briefing from Michael Goldfarb, who's in Mosul in northern Iraq. We're going to hear the latest from him. And then the rest of the hour will be spent with a folk musician talking about folk music during wartime. So stay tuned.
1-800-909-9287 is the number to call, make a contribution to help out, or online at WBUR.org with your contribution of $60, or maybe you can afford $120 or $365. That's just a dollar a day. And for your contribution of $365, we'll thank you with the On Point Fleets jacket, with the On Point logo showing brightly on the chest. And even though it's a little cold and rainy and snowy out, it is getting to be spring, so a fleece jacket would be pretty good right about now. 1-800-909-9287.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Century 21 Real Estate, featuring 165 full-service brokerage offices throughout Massachusetts, on the web at century21.com/MA. And Gregorian Oriental Rugs. 3 generations spent educating people in the art and culture of Oriental rugs. Gregorian's a little part of Persia in Newton Lower Falls. And Corey McPherson Nash, a design firm developing branding, print, and interactive communication solutions. Thoughtful design embedded in creative strategy. CMNDesign.com.
Hour 2 of On Point, just a few short minutes away. Help pay for the news that's important to you with a contribution at 1-800-909-9287 or online at WBUR.org.
WBUR supporters also include David L. Babson & Company, investment advisors for over 60 years, helping institutions and private clients build and preserve wealth. David L. Babson in Cambridge and on the web at dlbabson.com. and the independent bar and restaurant Union Square Somerville, featuring Chef Mark Yusevich's innovative Mediterranean cuisine. Reservations, menu, and music information at theindo.com.